supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Stress. For most people, stress is like the weather. Everybody complains about it, but nobody really does anything about it when you think about it. That's odd to me, because generally when we suffer with almost anything, we do something quickly to change the suffering. One could even say we live in a culture that's obsessed with fixing what ails us right away, but not stress. So, all joking aside, we know what stress does to us, and we're learning more. We know it affects blood pressure, our heart, cardiovascular disease. It affects many of our organs. It increases our risk for depression in ourselves and in our children, raises our risk for having an anxiety disorder, insomnia. The list goes on and on. So why do we have so much? Why don't we do anything about it? And realistically, what could we do about it? I have a guest on the line today who's going to answer all those questions on today's show. His name is Dr. Saki Santarelli. He's the director of the Stress Reduction Clinic at the University of Massachusetts Memorial Medical Center. He's an assistant professor in the Division of Preventative and Behavioral Medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. Saki, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Dan. Thank you for having me.
And you're going to answer all those questions?
Well, I'm going to do my best to try and perhaps pose further questions and make some comments. I'm not sure I'll answer them all.
Spoken like a true healer. Questions beget questions. Let me give out the phone number for our guests, for our listeners. Number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're talking about stress, what it's about, and really how to manage it. Please call early in the show. I have a feeling we're going to get backed up with calls as the show progresses. So you said that when you speak with your buddy, your colleague, Jon Kabat-Zinn, you guys joked together that in the early 80s there was no stress. But that's really only a half a joke. There really was much less stress back then.
Well, it seems like it. I think that essentially since the early 80s, people's perception of feeling stress and strain and the culture's demands upon us have grown exponentially, and I sort of mark it as the sort of crossing the early threshold into the digital age, and the way that time has been compressed and work weeks have been extended, and one is expected to do far more with less in some ways, in many ways, actually, has really created much more strain. We certainly see in the participants who participate in our stress reduction clinic that time has become an increasingly powerful factor in regards to their own experience of stress and strain, and even insofar as it becomes very difficult to find, in quotes, or make the time to, as you put in the beginning of the program, to do something about it in the face of knowing it very well, both psychologically, emotionally, and very viscerally right in the body.
I want to challenge something. You said people are expected to do much more with less. And at one level, that's certainly true. But in another way, our attitude about having much more seems that whatever we have is not enough, and we feel we need more in order to feel safe, secure, diminish our anxiety.
I agree. I think that you've put your finger on something. And so the more with less that I was referring to is that I don't know if this is actually accurate economically, but I do wonder about it, that in part, while America's productivity has gone up in the last decade or so, as economists report, I see as well that oftentimes in the workplace, people actually report to, when they come to our program, that they are in situations where there used to be, for instance, 7 workers, and now there are 5 workers. Mm. And so those 5 people that remain wind up having to do 7 people's work with only the resources of 5 people. On the other side of that coin, as you describe it, I think you're absolutely right that we are driven in some ways by wanting more and more and more and feeling like it's never enough and that unless we have it, we won't be complete.
Right, and we don't even know what the it is because we're going too fast to try to get it.
Right. I think, and in part, I think as well that, you know, Linda Stone, who was a Microsoft researcher, coined this term, and Tom Friedman made it sort of famous in his New York Times columns, but she said back at the Davos Economics Festival several years ago that we're now living in a state of continual partial attention.
Yeah, I think that language is interesting. Will you describe what she means, what you mean, and what are the implications of that?
Well, I think that, you know, I can't speak for her, but what I think she means is that essentially what's happening is that we're supposed to be doing many things at once. And in fact, the culture, particularly the culture of work, actually tends to stroke us for imagining that we are great, in quotes, multitaskers. Now, the research is pretty clear that multitasking is not really possible, that what the mind is, the brain is actually doing is it's switching its focus of attention very rapidly from one object or subject or task to the next, and that over time it tends to be exhausting and ultimately somewhat less productive. Rather than dedicating our focused attention and energy towards one item and then the next and then the next. Now, of course, we all have a lot to do, and we also have a lot to sort of keep on our plates, if you will. So no one's denying that. It's really the strategy of how do we actually go about taking care of those things and asking ourselves, well, what's required now? So what I think Linda Stone was saying was that we're trying to do all of those things all the time. We're trying to listen to the BlackBerry, type on the computer, keep one eye on our children, and on maybe the person who walked through the door while we listen for the airline's announcement about our flight either being delayed or on time simultaneously.
Why? You said we all have a lot of things on our plates, and you are right, and I want to understand why. You began our conversation indicting the microchip. And I agree with you. I think in large part rightly. But there's something that is happening to all of our brains. I look at myself with my email.
Yeah.
I know the most efficient way to live my life and get my work done is not to look at my email until late afternoon when the bulk of my work is done, when my brain can rest a bit, and then I can answer email. I know that. And yet, every single day, I check my email first thing in the morning. I'm not able to do what I know I need to do.
Yeah. And do you have any sense of why you do that?
Because I'm nuts. That's not enough.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. All I can say is
it's anxiety like everybody else.
Maybe. It may also be that it's got some, you know, email is very seductive. You know, all of these things are, because in a lot of ways, and I mean that in the sense that they draw us in, and then they easily, at least this is my experience, I'll just talk for myself, they can easily become intoxicating, and then before I know it, if I simply keep that metaphor, I'm drunk. And it's an hour later, and I'm still answering the emails at the most productive time of the day for me, just like you.
Right.
And so what I think is that it's as if many of our habits and patterns and a lot of the ones that seemingly contribute to what we call stress and strain are culturally embedded. And so one of the deep culturally embedded processes I think that's going on in the early 21st century, and I'm really not indicting the digital chip. I think it's what it is. I think the question is we're not quite sure how to use that tool yet.
Right.
because it's a very good tool and a very useful tool, and yet I think we're on a very steep and yet slow learning curve about what does that actually mean. And so I, for myself, try and begin to pay attention to what's drawing me to do this, even though I've got my list in front of me of the three priorities for the day, and I'm still drawing myself into the email. And it's one thing to say I'm going to scan those emails to see if any of them have to do with these three priorities. It's another to get hooked into the bulk of them. And so I think that, you know, what works for me these days around that is to try and be more disciplined and regimented and say, I'm not looking until 1 o'clock.
Yeah. And, we can rationalize doing otherwise, but I think you've drawn a wonderful metaphor about drunkenness.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, I did an interview several months ago about an inpatient rehab program somewhere in the Midwest for internet addiction.
No kidding.
Yeah, and when they describe it, it really does sound like an addiction.
Oh, yes, I've heard about that in terms of people that just continually, you know, they spend most of their waking weeks surfing.
Yeah, I've there's a couple of people who I get 3 and 4 emails a day every day.
Yeah, now the other side of that, I think, is as well as that we've somehow built into the culture. Do you remember the old days when it was somebody sent you a letter? It came through the mail. They sent it on a Tuesday. You got it on a Saturday or a Friday or a Monday, maybe. And then you had another week or so to respond back. And nobody really complained about that. It was simply just part of the process. But now, because somebody sends me an email, there's a twofold expectation I notice. One, I suspect they have an expectation that since they sent it, I should respond. And I have the expectation, since they sent it, part of what it means for me to be responsible is to respond back. And you know what? That just doesn't work.
Right.
It just doesn't work.
In a 24-hour day.
It doesn't work. And not to have time for oneself, one's family, and to, in fact, create a kind of more well-rounded life. So I think ultimately a lot of what seems to stress us is the reason it's hard to get out from under it, as you were alluding to in the beginning of the show, is because it's nested like those Russian dolls in a larger culture's ideas about what it means to be competent, what it means to be productive, what it means to be, in quotes, professional, no matter what your work is, and responsible, and that we need to take a pretty good look at that.
Let me reintroduce you, and we're going to take a short break and come back and talk about what we can actually do to
okay.
begin to take care of better care of our brains and bodies. We've been talking with Dr. Saki Santarelli. He's director of the Stress Reduction Clinic at the University of Massachusetts Memorial Medical Center. He's an assistant professor at the Division of Preventive Medicine at the UMass Medical School. If you want to speak with him and me about stress and stress management, the number is 888-477-9499. We'll be back to the program in just a few minutes. But again, that's 877-9499. Now, I want to give you another phone number. Please write it down and please dial it. It's a very important number. That number is 888-345-9499. Again, that's 888-345-9499. Why do I give you that number? Because it is our spring fundraiser, and we're asking you to support Voices in the Family and programs like it. More and more in the world we live in, we get less and less programs like this, where you can sit back, have a conversation in some depth. It's a lot more than a soundbite. There's thought that goes into it. There's research that goes into it. And there's education that goes into it. If you like this kind of program, give us a call. Dial the phone, 888-345-9499. At the other end is my producer, my friend, Mike and Scott. And Susan Palenko, my other friend who runs
the Children's Service. Thank you so much, Dan, and thank you. Please do call us at 1-888-345-9499. Susan and I are going to keep this break very short because we feel that today's program is so important, so we don't want to take a whole lot of time away from that. But Susan, Voices in the Family is one of the staples here at WHYY. It's a program that has been here for a long time, and we want to keep it here and keep it strong. So please make that pledge of support. You can go online at whyy.org, or you can pledge on the phone at 1-888-345-9499. And Susan, we actually have exciting news because Dan's new book is out,
yes,
and that is one of our thank you gifts.
Hot off the presses for a $100 pledge of support during Voices in the Family right now. You can get Dr. Dan Gottlieb's Voices in the Family, A Therapist Talks About Listening, Openness, and Healing in paperback. And that is for $100 if you go to 1-888-345-9499 or go to whyy.org and make that pledge of support for Voices in the Family for WHYY. We have a mini goal of 20 calls or web pledges at this moment in time, and we are here supporting Voices in the Family. I have to be honest with you, when I moved here from New York, it was the first show I ever heard, and I thought to myself, oh my God, I've never heard anything like this. And I thought Mike and Scott was actually two people, but I thought it was Mike and Scott. But anyway, she does the work of two people, and she works extremely hard. So give us a call and show your support. 1-888-345-9499.
And like we said, Dan will be signing those books for you, so this is really a very special thing to have. You could think about that as a gift to somebody who loves the show, who loves Dan. Give us a call. Keep us busy here at 1-888-345-9499. Or, as always, make that pledge online at whyy.org. Our mini goal is 20, and we really want to reach that goal, so help us here. 1-888-345-9499. Voices in the Family is a very special show. WHYY does a lot in connection to the program. For example, our In the Spirit of Family series, where Susan and I collaborate, where we discuss issues that are important to all families out here in our region. If you want to come to one, we have one coming up next Wednesday on the 16th. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but for now, please make the phones ring at 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at whyy.org and get a copy of Dan's brand new book, Voices in the Family. And with that, Susan, we're going to return to the programming. Thank you for your support.
Thank you.
Penn supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit are providing evaluations to determine if you are suffering from depression. Symptoms may include mood swings, irritability, sleep disturbance, and lack of interest. Those who qualify may receive an initial examination and treatment with an investigational antidepressant for 3 to 12 months. For information, the DRU number at Penn is 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about something you may be familiar with, and that's stress, with Dr. Saki Santarelli. He's director of the Stress Reduction Clinic at the University of Massachusetts Memorial Center. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. If you want to talk about stress, if you've got it, why you have it, and what to do about it. Again, that's 888-477-9499. You know, Saki, one of my mantras when I give talks is it's never about the thing. It's about what the mind does with the thing. So, you know, we know some very wealthy people have financial anxiety and people of modest means don't. So it's not about the money. It's about the mind.
I agree.
And so would traditional psychotherapy, but most therapists would have us explore the meaning. What are the roots of it? So if someone has achievement anxiety, most therapists would have us look at what achievement means to us, how that played out in our families, so on and so forth. Your approach is different.
Yeah. It is different in some ways. I think it takes into account some of what you've described, but it is different in so far as we are certainly interested in people becoming more curious and and if you will, investigative or directing their inquiry towards some of those issues that you describe as meaning or meaning making. But more so than that, we're interested in people actually beginning to recognize that they can actually now this is a tough word, observe. It's a difficult word. It's not an accurate word. And partly in mindfulness meditation practice and in the, what we call mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is the method or approach that we developed here at UMass some 27 years ago. And we're now nearly turning the page on our 18,000 patient who have participated or completed actually this 8-week program. So so there's some sense of, well, here is this very radical process where instead of us asking people to begin to examine as they would in psychotherapy all the antecedents of their anxiety or of their depression or of their thoughts and emotions about various things, we ask them instead to do something much more radical, which is to actually get much closer to them than a cognitive examination, which is to actually feel what's happening in the body when those thoughts or emotions or situations arise.
So that a Western mind, or even a logical mind,
yes,
is going to say, look, the whole deal is about diminishing suffering.
Yes.
Why would I want to feel all this pain?
Well, that's precisely right. It's very counterintuitive because if you think about stress from the physiological point of view, you could say in the sort of grossest terms that the human beings are all, we're all hardwired to either run or fight. That's what classically the fight or flight response is about in the face of adversity. And it's a long evolutionary process that's developed over, you know, hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of years in the organism. And it functions really well. And oftentimes we are either running or fighting. Equally so, one doesn't have to believe me about this. All you have to do is, if you will, in quotes, watch your mind for 5 or 10 minutes. You'll notice that a lot of the time, and a lot of these almost 18,000 people we've seen in the stress reduction clinic say the same thing, that they are incredibly staggered by how much of the time the mind is in the past, or directed to the past, or directed toward the future. And so, since what we call stress is always happening in the present moment, it might make sense that we'd want to bring a little bit more of our resources to bear in the present moment, and the only way to bring those resources to bear is to turn our attention toward what's on the mind rather than away from what's on the mind.
Well, given that, let's see how that sounds from a practical perspective. We'll open the phone lines. Our number is 888-477-9499. We do have a couple of lines still open. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're talking about stress management, and how to care for ourselves with Dr. Saki Santarelli. He's director of the world-famous stress reduction clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Let's go to Lynn on line 3. Lynn, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. I'm going to just make this comment real quick, and then I'd just like to hear your feedback. I'll hang up because I'm actually multitasking. I'm in the car.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi. In my industry lately, there's been a lot of people now, we work from home, the home office. And, you know, on the balance of it, people offer this up as, hey, this is a real stress reducer. I can work from home. But I've found it's quite the contrary. Working from home with our cell phones and our email and our home office right there in the house is much more stressful. And I'd like to just hear your feedback on that, if you don't mind. And
will
I'm
you,
going to bring
will,
off.
Will you tell us how and why it's... Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Tell us how and why it's stressful for you.
Well, for instance, I'll give you a couple of examples. My husband made a comment to me one day. He said, I've seen you come busting out of the bathroom to pick up your cell phone. And I know someone else who told me that if he gets up in the night, at maybe 3 or 4 in the night, to go to the bathroom, he will find himself compelled, as he goes by the office, to go in and open his email. And, you know, we're a global company, so there's going to be something in there from somebody. And then he'll find all of a sudden it's 11 in the morning, and there he is in his pajamas, and he's just been doing his email the whole time.
All right, let me ask you one last question, and,
yes?
then I'll let you go back on the road, because I'm now you got me nervous about you driving.
Okay.
One last question.
Sure.
Are you willing to change?
Oh, yes. In fact, I have actually done quite a bit to try and change. I got rid of my BlackBerry, and I also now switch my laptop off at sort of, you know, 6 o'clock at it, instead of leaving it on all the time where I can hear it ping if it gets an email or whatever.
Good.
But I think there's more we can all do.
Good for you. All right. All right. Drive safely. Thanks for your call. Saki?
Yes, well, thank you, Lynn. Those are two actually good solutions right there to get rid of your BlackBerry, or at least suspend use of it at times. And likewise, instead of putting your computer on hibernate, that you actually turn it off so you don't hear it. It also means it's a little harder to log on. So at 4 in the morning, you may not have the same sort of... you may have the same desire, but you may not want to expend the energy. I think that, you know, it's as usual. Sometimes people working at home find it less stressful, and sometimes people working at home find it more stressful. In your case, Lynn, I mean, some of the stress is that there's no boundaries. And since there's no boundary on a geographic or physical level, and a sort of a space level between where you work and where you live, then what's required actually is that you make the boundaries. And so those two examples that you used are some of the ways of making the boundaries. Other ways may include the following. For instance, saying like on a Saturday, today I'm just not turning on my computer. Or on a Sunday, whatever that day happens to be, and just making that decision for yourself and saying, today's a day that I'm going to do these other things for myself or with my family, and I'm not going near the computer, even though it's in very close proximity. So I think in a lot of ways it's making boundaries. It's kind of like, you know, 120 years ago, Dan and I wouldn't have been talking like this very easily in terms of electricity and radio and et cetera, et cetera. And so when it got to be dark, if you didn't have electricity, the physical environment made the boundary. If there was a really bad snowstorm in Philadelphia 120 years ago, people didn't expect that the roads were going to be cleared by the time they got up and got back on the road for the commute the next day. And so now that's all gone by the board, and those sort of physical limitations don't work anymore. We can switch on the lights at night. We can stimulate ourselves at night. We're a sleep-deprived society, even though it's built into our sort of physiological makeup to know when we're tired. And so we're being faced to make the boundaries in a way that always, and this is part of the stress, when you make a boundary like that, or when I make a boundary like that, we're always going to push up against the cultural river.
I want to piggyback on that, Saki, about what happens when we create that boundary. What happens when we turn the computer off on a Saturday? That we're not going to be relaxed. That I'll talk about myself. That's going to be accompanied with anxiety. A piece of my mind is going to be wondering, but it's an opportunity to learn something about ourselves, to see how anxious we get, what the anxiety is about, and I could almost guarantee, I would imagine you could too, Saki, that the next time you do it, it's going to have less anxiety.
Well, it may or may not have less anxiety, but I think that that's exactly what I'm suggesting, what I'm saying. Let's take up the possibility of turning toward, in this case, the anxiety of not turning on the computer on Saturday versus simply resting in the familiarity of turning it on, because we think that turning it on is sort of ameliorating the anxiety, and it's simply perpetuating something else, which is a kind of internal drivenness that is very hard to check once it gets some momentum. So turning off the computer, it's worth turning off the computer for that kind of learning possibility and beginning to understand, oh yeah, here's that feeling of kind of hollowness in my belly right now, or I notice I'm a little snappier, or I'm a little bit more disoriented because I'm not engaged in my life in the way I usually am.
Yeah, it's even more than that. I what we are doing in that process is slowly but surely we're beginning to retrain our brain. Each time we do that, we're creating new neural pathways.
Right. It doesn't feel like that for people in the beginning. And what I describe that it is often a kind of subterranean work. I know, for instance, in our clinical work, since it's an 8-week program, often the first 3 weeks people say, and there's a program at Jefferson Medical School modeled after our clinic up here, but people will often say, you know, I'm getting worse.
Right.
I feel more strain, I feel more pain in my body, I feel more anxiety, and I thought this was supposed to help me. And what's really happening, at least as I see it over, you know, I don't know, 27 years of clinical work here and in other places, that what's happening is that people, if they're beginning to do the methods and practice the methods that and practices that we basically require if you participate in the program, then which have a lot to do with learning to the practice a form of meditation known as mindfulness, and then beginning to realize, wait a second, this isn't just about taking 20 or 30 minutes or 45 minutes a day to practice a method. This goes beyond those 45 minutes into the sort of marrow of my life, and that's where, the rubber does meet the road.
That's I want to talk about that in some more.
But to sort of just finish out this point, what's happening in those 3 weeks, I think, are that people are building a foundation. And if you've ever built a house, you know, when you take your friends and family over to the building site, and all that is up at this point is the foundation, and they've backfilled it already, so really all you see is a little concrete sill along the ground, it doesn't look like much. And yet, if that foundation isn't there, there's no possibility of building a house on top of it. And so what I think happens in those first few weeks is that people are doing what I like to think of as the sort of underground work. They're beginning to flex a muscle, or really a set of muscles, that they haven't really educated before. And once they begin to get some feedback from those muscles, they begin to interface with all kinds of situations in their everyday lives, and even more so with their minds in new ways.
We're going to get to that in some detail. We're right up on a break here, and we've got to take that break. But I want to hear when we get back in some detail about how that works and how we actually retrain our mind. I know a lot of people think that we have to sit on a cushion for an hour a day in the morning, but there's mindfulness means lots and lots of different things. We're talking with Dr. Saki Santarelli, who's director of the Stress Reduction Clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. If you want to join the conversation, he's at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. And I want to give you another number I'd like you to call. And that number is 888-345-9499. We want to hear from you. We want to hear during our spring break how you feel about Voices in the Family, how you feel about programming like this. Is it worth your support? We ask 90 seconds of your time to call 888-345-9499 or go to whyy.org and give us a pledge. Keep things, programs like this and stations like this alive and healthy, and become part of it. Become part of something you believe in. It's good for everybody involved. We have Mike and Scott and Susan Palenko on the other end of the line.
Yes, absolutely. Give us a call at 1-888-345-9499 to support Voices in the Family, to support WHYY. We have a mini goal of 20 callers during this break. And by the way, we're keeping this break short so we can return to this very important program. And that means more of you have to call in a shorter amount of time. But we can do this. 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at whyy.org. And as Susan and I have been saying, the new book by Dan Gottlieb is out. It's called Voices in the Family. Ha, that's a good name.
Well, that's original.
Yes, that's original. It's a great name. And we would love to send you a signed copy of that book for your pledge of $100. Again, that's the new book by Dr. Dan Gottlieb called Voices in the Family. Or, since Susan, Letters to Sam, Dan's last book, was such a bestseller and such a hit, if you would like both books, make a pledge at the $200 level and we'll send you both books, Voices in the Family and Letters to Sam, for your pledge of support.
And I will say, Letters to Sam is a wonderful gift, so if you're thinking of maybe honoring your mother in your own family or anybody who is a mother-like figure for you, that's a great idea. Letters to Sam is a wonderful gift. If you give us a call at 1-888-345-9499 or go to whyy.org. Voices in the Family is a truly original program. It covers a breadth of topics very well and very thoroughly, and Mike and Dan do a wonderful job on a weekly basis. It's important that you become part of the family that supports Voices in the Family. 1-888-345-9499. It's a wonderful opportunity to help support this kind of programming here at WHYY.
Absolutely. Our number is 1-888-345-9499. Think about all the advice you've gotten over the years from Voices in the Family. Think about all the time you've had what we like to call a Dr. Dan moment, where maybe you were sitting in your car and all of a sudden you realized something based on what Dan has said during the show. So think about everything that WHYY brings into your life, all the information, all the compassion that comes out of a show like Voices in the Family, and then put a pledge of support behind that at 1-888-345-9499. Again, Dan's book, Voices in the Family, has just been reissued in paperback. It is re-edited, a new version of this book, mm-hmm. and we would love to send you a copy of that with your pledge of support of $100. Or, if you want both, if you want Dan's older book, Letters to Sam, and the newer book, Voices in the Family, make a pledge at the $200 level and we'll send you two copies, and of course both are signed.
And really, Mike, and Dan, Dr. Dan is to me, he's like the first reason why you should become a member of WHYY. And if you listen to Voices in the Family, if you benefit from the advice, if you benefit from his insight, from the insights of his guests, and from the ongoing conversation that he has just about health, being healthy emotionally, physically, psychically, it really covers all bases. 1-888-345-9499 or go to whyy.org. It is a good reason to become part of our family here.
Absolutely, and we do a lot of outreach around this show, which is another way in which Voices in the Family and WHYY connects with this community that we're all part of. Mm-hmm. For example, next Wednesday we have another installment of our series, which is called In the Spirit of Family. We'll talk about children and mental illness. We invite you to come to that. You can find more information on the website. We just did a great panel discussion here at WHYY about autism. This is the kind of work that we do, but we need your support. So please make that pledge and make it online at whyy.org. And with that, let's go back to Voices in the Family.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, Susan, and to those of you who have called in and pledged via the internet, I want to thank you all from the bottom of my heart. We're talking about stress with Dr. Saki Santarelli, who's director of the Stress Reduction Clinic at the UMass Medical Center. When we left, you were talking about your program, and before we go back to that, we've got a a caller, and I'm going to summarize her question. She wanted your opinion on anxiety meds. And when I opened the show, I said, you know, stress is something we complain about, but nobody really does anything about it. And when I was saying that, I thought, well, a lot of people do. You know, they go to their doctors and they go to the medicine cabinet to try to manage stress. What are your thoughts about that, Sarah?
Well, I actually think that that's one of the ways, two of the ways that people attempt to manage their stress. I think that people actually are trying desperately to handle their stress more effectively. And I just think as a culture, we haven't been educated very well about these, about how to do that. So I see that people are desperate to do it, and I think that one of the ways that people do it is to rely on medical interventions like anti-anxiety or antidepressive drugs. And quite frankly, I think that they can be tremendously helpful to people at times along the way. I think equally so, lots of people go into psychotherapy or into some kind of counseling process for the same reasons. I think people are going to the gyms and exercising in larger numbers than they were a decade ago. And so in the domain of exercise, what I think is that the sort of onslaught of stress both inwardly and outwardly, so outwardly via the culture, inwardly via our own conditioning and habits and patterns, is just often enormous. And since we don't have a good set of methods, if you will, where people can begin to get a toehold or a foothold or a fingerhold on these things and then slowly begin to sort of gain ground, it's hard to move forward. So I think that people do a lot. And I know in our own case, we've run studies with people with, you know, psychiatrically diagnosed anxiety and or depression, often secondary to their medical illnesses, because we're not running a psychological service. We're actually running a service for people often who have medical complaints of one kind or another, but still have anxiety and or depression, because it comes with the territory, if you will. And in cases of people taking medication against matched against people that are not, the outcomes haven't mattered. I mean, the outcomes were the same whether you were taking medication or not. So I certainly think that when people need to buy time, if you will, medication is a good way to do that while people begin to develop a whole other range of self-care skills. Additionally, I think that, you know, Dr. David Eisenberg at Harvard Medical School made two landmark studies back in the 80s and 90s, basically saying that Americans were spending vast sums of in the hundreds of billions of dollars on, in quotes, alternative and complementary medical therapies, a lot of them having to do with things that they could do for themselves, like meditation, like yoga, like biofeedback. And I think that that's all pointing at the fact that the amount of stress in the culture is rising, and people are attempting to find ways to handle it.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, meditation really is about looking at the mind, and I want to talk a bit about what the mind is, because that was one of the major impacts for me when I started doing this now about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But the mind is not just a brain. It's not a soul. Most assume that the mind is really in charge of the machine, who we are. And you know, John Kabat-Zinn often quotes what the Buddha said when he talked about disavowing personal pronouns, I, me, and mine. Why is that important?
Well, I think it's important because I think what's happened is we've developed a very narrow view of what me is or what a human being is. And largely speaking, because we live in a culture that has reified the objective and the objectified a lot of things in for the sake of being able to be repetitive, being able to be standardized, the differential diagnosis and the development of treatment outcomes for a particular diagnosis is one of the great triumphs of Western medicine, in terms of a certain kind of specificity of treatment for a specificity for a specific illness, condition, disease. And that has taken a very step-by-step rational process. In fact, that's what Hippocratic medicine from its onset was about. And in ancient Greece, Hippocratic medicine ran alongside another kind of medicine, which was called Aesculapian medicine. Aesculapian medicine didn't disavow Hippocratic medicine, nor did Hippocratic medicine disavow Aesculapian medicine. But Aesculapian medicine basically dealt far more with the subjective evidence, with the inner processes of human beings. You could say that psychotherapy and probably psychiatry has arisen out of Aesculapian medicine, having to do with a kind of study of the mind as larger than discursive of thought and our usual rational conceptual mind.
Tell us the value of disavowing these personal pronouns. What will that do for us, and how do we do it? Certainly easier said than done.
Well, the value of it is in this way. Look, the truth of the matter is there is an I. You're talking to me from Philadelphia. I'm here in Worcester, and I'm not disembodied, nor are you. And so in the relative sense of the word, there is an I, and there is a me, and I'm sitting in my office now, and you're sitting in your studio. But if that becomes the whole view of who one is, it's very narrow. It's sort of like you and I can define ourselves, and your listeners as well, as nouns, because they're very comfortable. But what if we start viewing ourselves more like verbs?
So who
we're
who
a lot
are
more
you?
Dynamic and a lot more fluid. And so in the meditative practice, what is being asked of people is to begin to become much more attentive to the body as a kind of as housing enormous domain of sensation.
Well, let me ask who you are. How would you describe yourself?
I don't know.
You're clear about that.
I don't know exactly who I am, because it, you know, you could say, Dan, it all depends. So there are lots of definitions for who I am. You keep every now and again at the break naming some of those definitions of who Saki Santarelli is. And during those breaks, they name some definitions of you as a writer, as a person who's just put another book back in print, who's running this radio show, who teaches stress reduction. So there's a lot of who we are, and there's nothing wrong with all that. The problem is we actually get caught in the labels, and so that I, me, and mine can become very constricting. If, for instance, you think you are your thoughts, or I think I am my thoughts, then there's no there. Then that's what I reify, and that's what I hold as the most true.
We talk a lot about the inner critic, and you know, most therapists do. I don't know if you do in your program, but I know people who have that inner critic, which involves most humans I know.
Yeah, including myself.
Right. Take the voice of that critic, either literally or take on the responsibility to destroy that critic.
Right.
So they have a fight or flight relationship with that inner critic.
That's precisely right. And we actually take a whole nother tack, which is, well, instead of fighting with that critic, instead of denying that critic, instead of running from that critic, what if you actually turn and face the critic? What if you actually begin to actually question the veracity of that critic? What if thoughts are just, in quotes, thoughts, rather than always true? Why is it that we believe that everything that passes between the space between the ears must be so?
I recently did a consultation with an 8-year-old boy and his mom, and the boy was starting to have nightmares and you know, afraid to go to bed at night, which is typical for that age. And you know, I told him that what's happening happens to a lot of kids. They begin to understand about what death is, that it could happen to them, and it's scary. And I said, when I was a child, I was scared. There was always a boogeyman under my bed, and I was scared that, you know, if I moved, he'd know I was there.
Yeah.
So the kid looked at me, and he says, "Where'd the boogeyman go? Is he still under there?" And I said, "Well, I have to tell you the truth." I said, "The boogeyman's still under there." I said, "But after all these years, you know, he's pretty tired now, and he rarely comes out. And you know what? When he does, it's like a visit from an old friend. I'd miss him if he went away after all these years."
And what did he do?
He laughed.
Yeah,
he
you know, I got two examples here around this. For instance, it's not unusual, and I never say this to anybody. You know, hopefully I will never say it, but I haven't, at least up to this point. But I've had many, many patients say things like this. "Well, you know, I've really discovered I have cancer, but I'm not my cancer." So what they've done is realized that they, whoever they are, is bigger than their thoughts. That's the same way with somebody. It was, you know, some years ago, our clinic classroom was right on the seventh floor in the hospital. So, you know, you either ride the elevators up those seven floors or you have to walk the stairs. Now, if you're somebody who has fear of heights or fear of enclosed spaces, guess what you would do? You'd walk up those seven flights. So every flight is 13 stairs, a platform, 13 more stairs. So you got to do 26 stairs times 7 to get to our classroom. And
I hate to do this to you. I have to ask you to telescope this story quickly.
Yeah, it's going to be very quick. So I started noticing that people in the class who were avowed unwilling to ride the elevator were stepping off the elevator. And I said to them, "What's going on?" They said, "I have the same sensations in my body that I had when I was afraid of riding the elevator. But you know what? They don't bother me so much."
The issue is, and the success story with this is, we are no longer afraid of our emotions. We're no longer afraid of our thoughts. They're just emotions and thoughts. Saki Santarelli, thank you so much for joining us.
We've gotten more familiar.
Saki Santarelli is director of the Stress Reduction Clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. He's an assistant professor in the Division of Preventive Medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He's going to be here in Philadelphia presenting a workshop, A Day of Mindfulness, Meeting Yourself, Meeting the Other, at Jefferson Hospital on May 19th. You can get more information at jeffersonhospital.org. As Mike said earlier, join us on Wednesday, May 16th. For a special In the Spirit of Family. My panel and I will discuss options for children affected by mental illness and help for their parents. We'll be talking about how family members can be supportive. That's right here taking place at WHYY from 6 to 8 p.m. on Wednesday, May 16th. Admission is free. Look us up at whyy.org. And I want to thank you all for listening to Voices in the Family today, and thanks to Jon Kabat-Zinn. I think we're going to be going back